If you see something, say something. At Reply, weird things come with any weird story you find on the web, and you can help make weirdthings.com even weirder.
It's 1890, and the citizens of Boston are beginning to go missing in the fog. Police are confused, the public is frightened, and the city is on the edge of hysteria. It's up to the mysterious Smith, inventor and adventurer, to figure out what's going on with the help of his assistant, April Malone. We'll have to face off against a secret society, corrupt policemen, and a mad psychologist hell-bent on dissecting Smith in order to solve the mystery of what's going on and to save the city from a more sinister threat. It's The Chronological Man, The Monster in the Mist, a fast-paced 45,000-word tale of science adventure, written by Andrew Main. And it's available to you for only $1 on the Amazon Kindle store. Download it on your Kindle, iPad, or any major phone, including iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, and Windows 7. Either way, don't miss The Chronological Man, The Monster in the Mist, available for only $1. Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, weird things and weirdos, welcome to another edition of the Weird Things Podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Mr. Justin Robert Young.
Yo, folks. Ho, ho, holidays.
Mr. Brian Brushwood.
Get it, that's Martian for get it, which is Orcish for hello.
Oh, wait. We have one more person joining us right now.
Is that a whisper in the wind?
That's right.
What can this be?
Can you feel it?
The spirits, they're manifesting right in front of us. It appears to be.
Hello, it's Bonnie Brushwood.
Oh my God, we got a girl on this podcast. I think that happens like once a year. We manage to convince a woman, a female of the species, to come on here.
Now, unfortunately, this one is here to ask us to answer for our crimes against her family for the last year and a half.
What?
Yes. Oh, come on. It's been easily several dozen episodes since we've murdered Bonnie or your kids and forced you to make horrific decisions on which one dies first and how painfully.
It has been. You know, he got a talking to, and then I think you guys got a talking to, and then I think you guys got that straightened out.
Let's get started right off the bat. We're going to play out a little scenario here. Brian?
Yes.
Bonnie?
Yes.
You guys are, under the definition of the law at least, considered responsible adults.
As far as the state knows or understands, yes.
Right.
You have children, you have pets.
Right.
Okay. And so, more so than perhaps Justin or myself.
Yes. Oh, if it was a contest of responsibility between you and Justin versus me and Bonnie, I think we win hands down.
Yeah, there's no argument there at all.
Oh, brag about it.
I'm so responsible, I have a mortgage.
Well, I don't know. I think they just haven't tested the responsibility skills. So yes. You guys have yet to be tested. How about
that's
that?
A really fancy way of running away from it full speed.
So I want you guys to play this out, and here's what I want you to pretend, okay? I want you guys to imagine that you're heads of a research institute. Like, you know, you guys run it together. Like, and after that, you're like, yeah, this magic sideshow stuff is bull.
That's something you don't hear often. Well, I went down to the mom and pop research institute.
No, that's what we called. It was BB and B's Jenna Global Enterprises. the happy little hometown DNA research laboratory.
There you go.
I'd like to support that.
Exactly
DNA
the spirit.
Research.
You want to do something for humanity, okay? And you hired some scientists and stuff. Justin and I showed up and we got some degrees. You didn't look too deeply into where we got them.
Our slogan here at BB&B's Jenna Global Enterprises is double blind, right on time.
Yeah, maybe you got a grant from some of your rich friends or something like this. And you guys, responsible people, we're going to put you in charge of kind of like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, okay?
Right, only we're BB&B Jenna Global Enterprises.
Exactly. And Justin and I happen to be a couple of scientists who work for you.
Okay. Can we pretend that Bonnie dresses like Mrs. Claus and I'm Santa Claus? Like
Mrs. Claus.
We dress up as Santa and Mrs. Claus at BB&B's Jenna Global Enterprises, and we're so happy to have some roving scientists come in. Andrew, sit down. Sit down.
I just made a plate of cookies.
Oh, we start devouring the cookies. We got big grins on our faces.
Oh, it's been ages since I saw you last. What can BB&B Global Genetic Enterprises do for you?
All right. You remember how a while ago we started looking at like scary world-ending scenarios and things we can do to help humanity and to make the world a better place?
Oh, do I remember? Bonnie asks if I remember. Of course we remember.
Do you remember?
No, not really. It's inappropriate for you to call me out in front of the clients.
The longer you go on with your speech, the less you remember. Yeah.
Right. Well, we've got your notebooks.
Yeah. So you said, hey, you know this bird flu thing? Bird flu sucks. What can you guys do about it?
Bird flu?
Oh, we're asking you, though. Right?
Yeah. You're like, that was the conversation we had. You said, Justin, Andrew.
Justin, Andrew, what can you do about this bird flu?
Yeah. We've been working at a laboratory for
a year. Jesus, you lushes, you asked us to do something. We're coming back with results.
Well, here at BB&B, we have a lot of children who have scientific research to be discussed.
What are you talking about? I think proprietor of BB&B's genitalia laboratory is drunk on eggnog.
Oh, Justin, you'll be getting a special present in your research presentation
All
this
right,
year.
Well, hypothesis confirmed. Andrew, listen, we have some very important results that we would like to deliver to the fine couple. What are they?
Well, you tasked us with trying to figure out something about bird flu to help humanity come out with a better solution so we can prevent these horrific outbreaks. And we've been doing some experimentation, and we developed a helpful new tool, a tool we think can make a great stride in advancement of this. Are you ready? Justin? You ready?
This sounds
absolutely
delightful.
Listen, now let me just say this. Because of our research, we are going to be well prepared for every possible scenario in this area going forward. It is a great step in the preservation of humanity.
You ready?
This is big news for BB&B, Bon.
Yes. We've taken the bird flu virus. We've analyzed it. We've come up with a really innovative way to mutate it so we can study it. And we've got a version that is now airborne. Much more contagious than before.
Yep. This thing can kill half of humanity, lickety-split.
Wait,
Let me reach inside my lunchbox and pull out this thermos that I've taped up and set it on the table here. It's in there, guys.
Hold on.
Would you like another cookie?
Just one whiff of this thing, and you are going to be a living, breathing factory of death, coughing and belching your way to complete human extinction.
Is that what we asked them to do?
Just for a moment here. Pretend I didn't know everything that there was to know about bird flu. And explain to me, like, you're saying bird flu wasn't airborne before.
No. But, see, what I'm saying is, old bird flu be getting contagious like this. I just got contagion by this bird flu. But new bird flu be getting contagious like this. Oh, hello, sir. I think I'm dead.
Fully mammal compliant, okay? None of this, you know, will it jump the species break? We solved that problem. We fully solved this problem.
On behalf of myself,
you've completely dropped the shtick.
No, in fact, I'm peeling off the white beard. At this moment, and I'm pulling out the pillow.
Hey, this was her favorite part about working about here.
Yeah, I know. You know what? It was my favorite part until now. Listen, what the hell were you guys thinking?
You didn't hear the best part. Bring in our research helpers. We bring in a cage. It's sealed in plastic, and inside you go. Are those weasels?
I'm sorry. They're you actually have weasels.
They're ferrets, but they look like weasels.
Okay, but you're bringing ferrets into BB&B. Why?
Yeah, we'll use the ferrets to help create the strain of highly contagious bird flu.
Okay.
It could wipe out half the population.
Again, what was your goal here? You sat down thinking, I want to help Santa Brian, and what? What?
Technically, we started this research in March, so you were Leprechaun Brian.
Okay, yeah, back when I was Leprechaun Brian, before BB&B. Look, we are big on holidays here at BB&B. When last we met, I was Scarecrow Brian, and then I was Horn of Plenty Brian, but now I'm Santa Brian, and Santa wants to know, why have you guys been some bad boys? What was your plan? What were you thinking?
Who are you saying's on the naughty list? Now partially Santa Brian, as Mrs. Claus shuffles the thought to be homemade cookies back into the Entenmann's box.
No, seriously, sell me on why this is a good thing that you guys cooked up a superbug to kill everyone.
Well, I mean, the worst case scenario is this thing is ready to hop from animal to animal to humans in an airborne way. And how are we going to know how to solve that problem if we don't know what that looks like? Duh.
Exactly. And that, which is why the reason why we're here is not only to show you that we have made this fantastic scientific breakthrough discovery, but also
using ferrets.
Yeah, using ferrets. But if you just sign this piece of paper, we plan on distributing it to the entire world.
Okay,
Justin's already got his iPhone out and his finger on the publish button.
Wait, were there three ferrets? Because I'm only counting two.
There were actually four.
There were 10 generations of ferrets. Okay, we had to evolve the saying, this is science.
Yeah.
Okay, when you say distribute to the world, you're talking about to yahoos at the 7-Eleven or people with paper degrees? What define distribute to Santa?
I mean,
people
pretty much
at conferences who read illicit pornography on airplane flights between them.
Anybody who's got a computer, iPhone, Kindle Fire.
People interested in violence. Nope. That could wipe out humanity.
Hold on. Let me pull back the curtain here for just a second, gentlemen. Are you saying that in a real life
you keep all your costumes?
That's it. Yes, exactly. And now let me dress
I didn't know
up.
You were Arbor Day Brian.
Now I come out as Baby New Year Brian.
That's my favorite.
I say, well, golly gee, Andrew and Justin, it sounds to me like you're constructing a scenario where somebody has taken some vital information and disseminated it to any old terrorist who wants to cook up a super flu.
Well, we're not at the point where it's been disseminated yet.
That doesn't make sense.
You're saying, tell me this is not real. Tell me this is one you totally made up and is not based on anything.
Brian, every single thing we made up, including the ferrets, is real. The scientists in Rotterdam, the Netherlands, have developed a strain of bird flu. They used ferrets 10 generations. After 10 generations, they created a strain of it where it mutated to become airborne, which means any ferret that became ill from it, could make any other one sick just by being nearby.
And what kind of kill ratio did it have? What was the survival rate?
It's like bird flu right now, like infections, like a 50% survival rate.
Wow.
So probably the same. And
half, Eddie, half.
Yeah.
Did you just make a reference to Eddie Murphy Raw from the mid-80s?
No. If they didn't get it, they don't deserve it.
Okay.
There are only 5 mutations in the DNA that it took to do that. So, and they say this would be about as contagious as seasonal flu, which, kills tens of thousands of people every year.
Yeah, but I mean, now the current survival rate for flu is pretty high. I mean, it's the elderly and kids that you worry about. But if we're talking 50%, that would be brutal.
That's almost half. Yeah.
That would be utterly devastating. Now,
was the Walgreens struggling, trying to sell their flu shot?
That's right.
They just really wanted to come up with one that got everybody.
Yeah, who commissioned this? Who's the money behind this?
Yeah. Like, why are they Did they come up with a cure? That's what I'm curious.
Well, no, but to get to a cure, we need to create, you know, a very scary strain. This was made at the Erasmus Medical Center in Rotterdam. And so the scientists want to publish. They say, hey, listen, in order to, you know, move this research forward, we need to publish this so other scientists can look at this. But people are worried because they're saying, like, you know, any ne'er-do-well with a bunch of ferrets could create this.
Now, is that, man, this is a tough question, because this is one of those, like, information wants to be free issues where it's like, yes, scientific advancement does much better when you know, we have sunlight and full exposure and full dissemination of information. But I don't know. I mean, that's some scary business.
You know, that's always a very interesting, you know, sort of – it's a thing – it's an ideal that I think we all sort of hold true. But then when you start applying situations, it's like, what if I told you there was a 1-800 number and then a PIN code that you could enter that would start an all-out nuclear strike because Reagan got crazy one night? Should we release that? You know, and we'd be like, well, of course not. Well, then we're like, well, then we'd say that information shouldn't be free.
Oh, man, you did a really good job of graying things up here, because I tend to, in general, be on the side of information wants to be free and on balance people are good. But your Reagan example just blew my brains out, because it's there is a too far.
Nothing muddies the waters like a drunk Ronald Reagan metaphor.
Yeah, like in the science, you know, the generals and scientists are like, listen, he's not going to remember it.
Yeah, I know.
No, when
you're
drunk. He decided to go check his voicemail one night.
800 Nukem.
True story, though, about Reagan. He actually, when he first got in office and he met with the heads of the Soviet Union, he wanted to unilaterally just get rid of all the nuclear weapons. And our generals are like, listen, in Europe, it's the only thing that's keeping us, you know, from having, you know, a wave of, you know, Russian force, Soviet forces, you know, roll their tanks right on through.
So, oh, my gosh. Really? Because that's not what I remember of his administration at all. That's amazing.
Well, well, I mean, that's he had a personal inclination to go one way, and then the facts kind of dictated it. You know,
the problem he had with the Star Wars defense shield is he really, you know, thought, let's have this defensive thing so we don't have to worry. But, you know, of course, if you have this wonderful defensive shield that nobody can attack you from, the people on the outside of that shield are very scared by that and don't quite see it in the sort of very hopeful light that you do.
Yeah. Well, and especially also if it unfortunately, another side effect would be that would essentially legitimize, well, heck, you got that shield. Why not throw a bunch of nukes your way? Oh, did one slip through? Well, how are we to know?
Yeah, there's that too, Dr. Strangelove. So you, Justin, you ready to publish this? We're good to go?
Number one, we have to publish this. And I mean this in all seriousness. And for the simple reason that it's out of the bottle. I mean, this was not a gigantic government initiative. This was not the Manhattan Project. A bunch of Dutch dudes with a pack of ferrets created a crazy contagious bird flu. You know, this stuff is possible now. We need good people who don't want to release this as a terrorist mechanism to give this to other good people so we can defend in case somebody wants to do it and they start turning these dead ferrets for evil as opposed to good.
Yeah, I think I'm on Team Justin here, and I may way, way regret saying this out loud on a podcast where it's recorded for all posterity. And if in some dystopian future it turns out that half of humanity is wiped out and it was directly because of the same sharing of information attitude that Justin
Josie
and I
share. Stumbles through the wreckage of humanity and finds a podcast player and listens to this, listens to her father
She's
say
like,
this.
Curse you, father. She's a smoker in the future. Ah! But,
But she smokes.
It's the post-apocalypse. You're going to get on her for smoking.
Yeah, well, that's that voice that I just kicked out. But here's the thing is technology advancements are always terrifying before we see the real benefit to them. You build an atomic bomb before you build a nuclear power plants. You build an electric chair before you build, the washing machine or whatever.
See, I mean, this is why women need to be more inventors, because there's no way we'd make bombs and electric chairs.
Oh, man. You do not want to say that to Andrew Mayne. Andrew Mayne will come back with like all this like Marie Curie killed your grandfather.
I think that was emphysema, but go ahead.
Wow. Wow.
Speaking of smoking.
Well, I'm going to kind of side with Bonnie here a little bit. I'm going to explain why.
In sometimes your face, Santa Brian.
Yeah. Because, I mean, here's
do you
my
want the belt
this.
Again, Mrs. Claus?
Oh. Here's my thinking. Like, there's technology, then there's like, hey, here's the shortcut to make this thing. Now, I would say that if I were a scientist and I came up with this, how would I do this? I'd be like, all right, I'm going to go talk to anybody who's responsible and wants to know. I will, you know, we'll have a conference where these people are vetted and we'll do that. If I go publish this on the internet and it's, and if we say the advantage we sort of have over the people who mean to do bad things is it's very expensive. They don't have as many smart people to work on these things. And so they have to be very, very careful what projects they choose to do. You know, Iran is really trying hard to develop, you know, nuclear weapons and, you know, some of our allies are doing their best to help them do that, but they've got finite scientists, they've got limited resources to do that, and the less they know about how to build atomic weapons, the more experimental errors they're going to make, the more screw-ups they're going to have, the more centrifuge accidents they're going to have, you know, helped along by software that, you know, maybe we help create. And if there's a way to say, okay, if we can get the people who need to know and let them know and not make it so easy for the people we don't want to know, it gives us another 18 months, another 2 years ahead start on, you know, that. That's my thought.
But on what? Like, what are we going to do with a head start against Iran? I mean,
against, like, somebody who wanted to use this in a bad way? Like, we're rapidly developing, you know, we're within 10 years' time. We may see the point where by the time you identify a pathogen, a virus pathogen, that, you know, before somebody could take off in an airport in Narita in Japan and land in Los Angeles, we could have the thing sequenced and have a, you know, a cure for that. We could have that genome sequenced. We could come a cure with that before the plane could land. We're getting to that point. There's a real progression of how much faster we're able to do these things. And we get to that point, you know, where it's going to be easier for people to create these things, but it's also going to be very, very easy for us to say, oh, we got this. Go to Walgreens, get inoculated. You're okay.
So you're on team do not publish?
I'm team publish within to people you think, you know, are qualified. Share it with, you know, respond all the other countries that have, you know, people doing research in this. Say, hey, you know, we're willing to have conferences and share these things because we want to do that. I don't know if I want to publish on, you know, Google Plus.
Well, this comes down to the hacker white hat versus black hat discussion, right? So it's like there are all kinds of stories of bugs that have been found in all kinds of websites or software systems where they send an email to the publisher, the creator of it, saying, hey, you got this security flaw. And they say, oh, yeah, no, that's great. Please don't tell anyone. Thanks. And then 6 months later, nothing happens. And then finally, they're like, okay, hey, world, there's this exploit in there. And then, of course, then they, you know, they freak out and they cover their bases. And sure enough, 3 weeks later, there's a security patch for it out there. So could it be the kind of thing where, especially because this doesn't sound like it was rocket scientists, it sounds like, it, you know, get yourself 10 generations of ferrets.
No, I mean, this was
biological scientists.
No, these were genuine. They're real experts. These guys knew what they did. And but you know, part of it is.
But I'm saying like it sounds like it was a simple set of steps. It wasn't like they used an unprecedented method to get there. Like it sounds like this was low tech.
No, I mean, I think that there's in any kind of procedure, there's enough things that can go wrong that if you're at a research facility where you have capable people can tell you like, oh, you know, if you use this containment procedure, you're going to have this problem because of the temperature. Little simple things like that, which we take so much for granted. We have so much institutional knowledge at our research facilities and places like that, that when people try to do these renegade or rogue operations and stuff, it's harder to do that. And it's often the simplest things can make a difference. But, you know, it seemed like it was a couple steps. But, you know, if it's a five-step process and there's uncertainty between them, you could have 1,000 different ways you can end up and not do it right.
Right.
And I would rather, and that increases our chances. And, you know, we have people actively trying to prevent the spread of these things. And we also have people, you know, people trying to develop cures for this stuff. And that it absolutely is a balance we have to figure out because, if we hold on to this information, we don't tell anybody. And there's some scientists who say, listen, we think we can solve this airborne problem. But if we knew what these mutations were, we could do it. And if you're not going to tell us, we're in a problem. And I don't think it's an easy answer. I'll just put it that way.
So you're saying a limited dissemination. Like if you know the secret password, You can come behind the curtain. We'll let you know what's going on.
The secret password being, I'm not a terrorist.
Yeah. The but, secret but password you're not, being... not going to send it to Cory Doctorow to put up on Boing Boing.
Well, and also, if the United States Army had developed this, you know, some people might argue that this was an illegal, you know, violated, you know, treaties we had as far as developing bioweapons. Mm. You know, wow. It gets into that, you know, area where you could arguably say that, like, listen, this gets in this area we're not supposed to even be in.
But I guess I kind of understand where these scientists are coming from. It's almost as if this future strain of this bug that probably would have evolved naturally is like a terrorist.
Yeah,
and we're just trying to get the jump on it. So
by bringing him into existence earlier.
Well, yeah.
We had to clone Hitler so we could kill him.
Yeah, a little bit of that.
But this time he could sing.
And rap.
Yeah. There are no easy answers here. So
no.
How about another topic? How about a fun topic?
My name is A.
Because girls just want to have fun.
Listen, are you sick of pompous television chefs getting all up in your business, acting like they know something? I am. I'm tired of them. That's why I've purchased this gun. And I'm going to hunt down each and every one of them until the only chef I'm going to see talking to me is on CoverVisions.tv. CoverVersions.tv. It's run by Diamond Club member Locafied. And you're going to want to get there. It's all about recipes and beautiful, delicious food. I don't really own a gun, and I'm not trying to kill celebrity chefs. But if I were, I'd be a huge fan of CoverVisions.tv.
This week, a kind of an interesting thing happened. And this is like a very, very, very nerdy. And I apologize, Brian, but Justin, Bonnie, and I are going to geek out over this, okay?
Oh, yay. Wow. I guess I'll just sit out here alone watching my sports channels.
What's on the NFWs? Brian, and when people talk about like the next innovation, the next cool thing that's going to come along, and what that's, it's always hard to know. You know, in the 1970s, 1960s, you had people excited about computers. In the 1970s, people excited about
cocaine.
Personal computers.
Oh,
poking? Yes, that too. You know, you had people excited about personal computers, but then it was just a bunch of geeks for that period. It wasn't until like the mid to late 80s that people were like, oh, you know, it's not just a thing you pose in front of with three other people wearing big glasses and, you know.
Beards. There was a beard.
Yes. So a couple weeks ago, I guess, when did this first go up? A Kickstarter started. Actually, it was, I think, about a week ago, a Kickstarter campaign launched. And it was a very, very cool premise. And we've talked a little bit before about rapid prototyping machines, RepRap, MakerBots. These are devices that can make other things, three-dimensional printers.
Oh, I know what you – you tweeted this out. This is huge.
Yeah. So a three-dimensional printer, for those who aren't familiar, in its simplest form is a thing that can make a three-dimensional object out of plastic. You design something on your computer using like Google SketchUp. You send it to this device. It sits there. It's the size of a microwave maybe. And a little tip extrudes melted plastic on a platform and it moves around and it can start making, you know, it can make toys. It can make plastic parts. It can make a lot of different things. And they have different varying degrees of resolution. And they have industrial versions of these things that are like $30,000. Some versions of these devices are actually being used now to make manufactured parts. There's a muffler company, or excuse me, there's like an air filter company that actually uses one of these, uses machines like this to make air filters that haven't existed for 20 years. Okay. The Army's working on this stuff to make parts for Jeeps and stuff. They actually have powdered metal ones. So if you're in the middle of, you know, a desert somewhere and you need a piston, this thing could make a piston. And so it's an exciting kind of technology because instead of having your stuff built halfway around the world, you go up to a device in your house, tell it what you want, and it would print you out this thing.
Now, here's what I can't believe I haven't seen already. I can't believe you don't have one of these personally for your magic fabrication business, because there's some weird shape doodads you need when you make a magic anything. And the system I use to control my sound and video during my stage shows, they're no lie. It's held together. It started with the keyless entry remote system for a car, and now it's held together with gaffer's tape and the spine of a VHS cassette that I just broke in half. And that is not even an exaggeration. That's a total truth. I got to imagine just having one of these around, especially, now I know, you know, for example, MakerBot, when we saw them at CES, I think they were saying $1,500 to $2,500 for a consumer grade unit. What's the target price point for this Kickstarter project?
Well, what's happened is a guy came out there and he took the, there's a version of this thing you can build yourself called the Rep Wrap. And when I say build yourself, I mean, if you're a neckbeard, you know, type person.
Yes. You actually, even if you're in, you know, you're inclined in the engineering sense, you have to wait until your neckbeard grows in physically before, I mean, like, you are endowed with, like, the powers.
Shake their heads when you say Linux isn't that easy to use. Like, what do you mean? All you have to do is just, you know, download the source file or, what you know, start explaining to you these things.
In fact, when you open the package, all these screws and pistons and little ball bearings fly out, and the spirit of Linus Torvald jumps out and says, "Do you know how to super use the kernel?" And then if you don't, I don't even know if I said Linus's name correct. I'm going to get busted on that.
He's the kind of guy who doesn't care. You know, he's that's what's cool about him. I would imagine.
No, he said that because he didn't care. However, there was the big question of whether it was Linux or Linux. And he's like, I don't care. It's free. Go.
Exactly. So there was this era in the 1970s where we had a lot of engineering types were very excited about computers. And I think it was like Merlin Mann had this great example. He says, a nerd is somebody who uses the telephone to talk to other nerds about the telephone. Okay. And that's kind of like where computers were. And then all of a sudden we have this idea of software and what you could do with this stuff. And then there was this whole new era of when people said, oh, well, I can create these things. I can create games. I can create all these things. Here's the platform. This is what I do on top of it. And we're kind of at that point right now with these 3D machines where a lot of very, very smart engineering type people are playing with these things, trying to figure out, well, what do we do with them next? And then there's going to be explosion. Well, this guy came along, Brookdrum, looked at the existing projects and came up with a Kickstarter campaign because he said, you know what? These things aren't cheap enough and easy enough to put in classrooms. You know, they're still $1,500, $2,000. They still take hours and hours to put together. He looked at existing open source models. He simplified it, figured out how to build a lot of the parts using one of these machines, one of these extrusion machines, and came out, realized that if he could sell enough of them, he could bring the price down for a kit to $500 where you could build it in 45 minutes. And so if you go to printerbot.com, and that's printrbot.com, you can see the link to the Kickstarter campaign. And so he launched this campaign and he figured to make this thing happen, if he could raise $25,000, that would be enough money to get enough parts to be able to, you know, go out there and produce these things at a $500 price point, which is amazing. It's a third of what anybody else has been able to do before.
I'll tell you what, this harkens back to.
I just tell you what? Just for an intersect break, okay? He needed $25,000. Do you know how much money he's up to right now? And he has 18 more days to go before the project's finished funding.
Oh, he's got to be overfunded.
$14.
Yeah. He's at $238,000.
Holy cow.
Do you think that shows a little enthusiasm?
Well, I would. Yes. Yes, Bonnie. I would agree.
Okay.
So, well, there's tremendous consumer potential. I mean, I wouldn't be shocked if this is coming from not only entrepreneurs who want to kind of get into this field, but also it would be kind of silly for, I mean, you can imagine two or three different kind of markets wanting to get in on the foreground of a machine that at this point in the technology can be released for so cheap.
Well, okay, so here's the thing. This reminds me of when our family got an Apple IIe. And mm-hmm. it was such a huge deal for us, and
spoiled
it was
spoiled bread.
Okay, yes, that's
yes.
Wow,
this reminds me of having to wait after school for an hour to play with the Apple IIe.
But the point is, it's like we knew that this computer was special and cool, but we didn't know why or for what or for how. Mm-hmm. We just knew that it was freaking awesome, and you could do magic with it essentially, right? And I remember, yeah, we would buy books from the bookstore filled with thousands of lines of basic code that we would enter by hand just so we could enjoy a text adventure that we ourselves had to hand write in order to do it, right? But we knew there was something special and magical and awesome about it, and I feel like this will be that experience for Penelope, age 7, or for Josephine, currently age 4, you know? And it's like, what was that magic moment in your family when you had something so awesome and you didn't even know where it was going to go, but you just knew this was magic?
I can tell you.
Yeah?
Yeah. We got a computer, too, when I was in high school. And And I sat down in front of a blinking cursor and didn't know what the hell to do with it. And I kind of feel like this.
That's what this is?
This is it. Like, I would sit down in front of it and go, okay, yeah. I don't know.
So meanwhile, like, I get in, I'm all excited, and, like, I print out a BB logo, which would be my first thing that I would
Of course you would.
BB&B Genen Corporation Global.
Well, that's a great example. I mean, that is – because I think the advantage I'd say that we have, we're a generation that remembers looking at computers and going, okay – we know what they do now is kind of cool, and we want to do this, but we see this other thing. And so a lot of people look at these 3D machines like, well, you're making things out of plastic. They're like, so what? Well, it's like you're making the BB logo out of plastic. It's like doing 10 print, you know, Brian, you know, in BASIC.
Exactly. Well, and that's how it starts. It starts when you have magic and you don't even know where you want to begin. So you make your corporate logo. And you're like, gee whiz, that's kind of cool. But then 3 years later, all of a sudden the hot new toy isn't available in stores and somebody writes a hack for you to print out that new action figure that's going for $50 on eBay.
Or legitimately sells it for download. But
yeah, you know, we could do that.
Right. But I'm saying, like, it's that weird workaround type thing that people get excited about. And then and then down the road, all of a sudden, you know, 10 years down the road, there's some pathogen, maybe some guys with a bunch of ferrets release out into the wild. And then all of a sudden you can use your home, nanoscale MakerBot Extreme Edition 8000 to...
You use the one you got off the BitTorrent version to do it, and it turns out it's an actual pathogen that infects you because
exactly.
It was the malware.
No, but now you're able to manufacture, like, custom air filters that block certain pathogens, or it's just like, it's the down the road that we can't even conceive of right now. Oh, yeah. That's the most exciting.
There are people right now working on ways to print out circuit boards using technology not much different from a computer printer, using ink on paper and stuff. And that's these things right now, they make plastic parts. You know, the next generation is going to, be able to do finer detail. And then we're going to get the ones that are going to be able to print out circuit boards and stuff like that. And yeah, it's absolutely, I think it's exciting. And you know, my hat's off to this guy,
I guess the thing that excites me is how raw this is. And it mm-hmm. reminds me of the last big experience that I had in my life that was this raw was the personal computer revolution, and to know that there's still awesome magic for my children to experience is very exciting.
I
thought magic was gone from these realms a long time.
Learning the computer program was a great, you look at the awesome things that we had in the 90s and this last decade of software technology, when you can sit by yourself in a room or a couple other people collaborate and make something. And now we're really going to move that into the physical space where two high school kids could get together and build a car in their garage using...
Fabricate every single part one at a time.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
This is absolutely, and I totally identify with you, Brian. Like, you just look at this thing, and you just want to grab it and hold it over your head and just be like, I'm a nerd. It just has all these hoses.
But that's the funny part is that, like, I don't, like, what are you going to do with it? You're like, I don't know, no. But it's awesome.
Exactly. I'm going to make a tiny little hockey stick, play paper hockey all day long, and there's nothing you can do about it, Dad.
I can tell you what show up around here is little tiny rudimentary versions of guinea pigs and
hedgehogs.
Oh, my
God. It would be nothing but toys for Penny. It would be anything she wanted. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's going to be the way it starts. I've got in my hand right now a glyph.
Do
you remember this? The Kickstarter project?
These guys were the first people who I felt like really understood Kickstarter as its own medium. They did a really hip advertisement for this little doodad that you just hook up to a iPhone 4 that you can use it to stand or put it on a camera stand or as a kickstand.
We chipped in for that.
Yeah, I think we did.
But we never got one.
Well, we didn't chip in enough, apparently.
Oh.
But the very first units were 3D printed, and in fact, if you couldn't wait for the mass production, they would 3D print them one-offs for you for, I think, like $25 each.
Hmm. Yeah, and you know, we're getting to the point where the 3D printers, if you look at some of the ones that right now, they print in these layers of plastic extrusion, so they have these sort of like ridges to it, but the more higher-end ones, it's harder to see those. And they're getting better and better to point either. But you can people sell, I feel bad for the glyph people, but you can get like a knockoff glyph on one of these websites that hosts these 3D files. And
wow.
You can, and but you know, point is though, is that you're going to get to a point where like you're going to get a next generation is might be like, hey, you know, hey, 99 cents, download our file for the GIF.
Now, you know, think about this. Think about this. Like, my generation saw the coming of software piracy, and I think in many ways, and music piracy, and I think in many ways the threat of it has been diminished a lot with video game software. I think the ease of use with Steam and some other services has diminished the value of the piracy. Same thing with music. iTunes makes it so cheap and easy to get DRM-free music that why bother to pirate it when you could get it legitimately? I think we're going to see growing pains with patented physical objects that people are going to want to pirate, and I think eventually there will be a service that will offer the equivalent of the 99-cent download for the sprocket runs the timer on your whatever.
I think the advantage we're going to have this time around is the people who are going to be creating the cool stuff, you know, aren't going to be these Leviathan Industries that are takes them forever to get the new model. You know, you have the thing like Thingiverse where you can upload models. I think the business models are going to be built from the ground up, like understanding that how easy it is to replicate that. And there's going to be the idea of like, okay, if I've created this, you know, my version of the glyph, how do I create some value to this? How do I find that right price point? And, you know, if I move it to that 99-cent price point where I feel like, okay, you know, that's it. I get this thing and it works. And if I have a problem, I can ask them about it. And I think the people making the stuff, you know, they're like you and I in that they've seen the folly of these industries who are around for 100 years and didn't get it.
Well, I'll tell you, there will definitely be some landmark case where some individual takes a patented device where they file the design of it in the patent office, and that's where he gets the file to start with, makes a modification that is clearly innovative and superior to the original, and then releases it to to the torrents, and this big company will want to crush this individual, but will be unable to because he'll be judgment proof because he has no money. He's some, you know, stoner kid half a world away who's got no assets. And then meanwhile, the whole world
struck a crushing blow against Spacely sprockets.
Exactly. but like, this is going to happen, and not even in a jokey kind of way. This is very exciting to me that this can occur.
Yeah, I just want to make sure that we create a climate where we encourage people to spend the time and sometimes the capital to create without too much of a fear that they're going to get ripped off. And that's a danger you run into. And, you know, I just spent time in China where, you know, you have kids there that wouldn't even think about putting out a magic trick because they know that the magic shop down the road will copy them and, you know, sell it, you know, whatever, discount them. And, you know, it's a huge, huge problem in that community there that it almost stifles creativity.
Andros Lee has supported this podcast by buying a $30 sponsored spot and asking me to repeat the following sentence. Buffalo, 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 buffalo. Thank you, Andros.
Can we tell everyone about your adventure in China? Because this is fascinating to me, and there's things that I haven't had a chance to ask you about it.
Sure, I was in China.
Yeah.
It was perfectly for capitalist reasons.
I was treated well. I was invited by the Ministry of Culture to go speak at a conference on magic, their big magic festival in Shanghai. And that was an absolute pleasure. I had a great experience. I got to meet a lot of really, really neat young up-and-coming and older Chinese magicians and acrobats. And so I was specifically there to talk about, you know, creativity and stage illusions and stage magic, and did a 3.5-hour lecture on that. It was a great, great experience. And spent 10 days there. It was awesome.
Well, and so what did you get out of their, I don't know, their perception of magic as a creative endeavor? I mean, do you feel like for good or for ill, the way China regards intellectual property as sort of a free-for-all, like, well, hey, I could duplicate it, so what? Do you think that we're headed towards that way, or we're getting away from it, or is it stifling creation over in...
That was a big concern, is that any... You know, the rest of the world in many ways feels like they're playing catch up to the United States. And part of playing catch up, you know, when when Jefferson and Franklin went over to France and they saw the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, they saw a lot of great ideas, and they came back to the United States and said, hey, guys, this is what we need to be doing. And so that's a part of our cultural genesis, too. But we also said, you know what, let's come up with ways to respect intellectual property. And you know, it's still a debate we're having to this day. But so other countries, you know, have we've done the same thing. And so there, a lot of it starts off like this is what they're doing there. And, you know, my stuff is hugely pirated, not just my DVDs, but my magic products are pirated over there. And, you know, which, you know, I kind of say, well, you know, I make my money in the first world, and, you know, China's an emerging first world country, so that kind of changes. And so when I went over there, it's like I didn't care. You know, that wasn't a thing that bothered me. The thing that concerned me was is I realized that there are other magicians there are not going to have the same opportunity that I had to be a magic creator, to be somebody who could make a full-time living creating magic, because I was lucky to live in a country and a culture where enough people were willing to pay for intellectual ideas.
Right.
That I could do that and I could devote myself full time. In China, there's a couple issues there. And one is, you know, China's attitude, you know, the official sort of attitude towards magic is they look at it and they got funding to put on the conference because to them, they want to win all the magic awards. They want to go to all the big magic competitions that we have. Like there's a big thing in magic, you know, there's the IBM convention. There's, you know, every couple of years, there's a big European one. And so a FISM. And so China wants to win those like they wanted to win the Olympics.
Wow. So, they're throwing state resources at becoming badasses in magic.
Absolutely. And their goal is they think that they want to be the number one in the world in everything, which is admirable. And their attitude is if they can win all the magic competitions, they're number one in the world, which it's like, well, David Copperfield, David Blaine, these guys, Penn and Teller, never won a magic competition in their life. You know,
right.
And that's sort of the idea that, like, I understand that part of it is that if you want to get the state funding, you have to justify an objective goal. But anyhow, you know, the problem is there's, you know, five. When I watched their, I went to go watch the competition shows, and I saw extremely talented people. They're not quite, you know, for the averages, nowhere near on the level of, let's say, the South Koreans. The South Korean kids in magic are amazing and they're creative, but there was a pretty good technical proficiency, but it was the same five tricks over and over again. You
right.
know, it's, you know, we joke about our magic conventions. It's like that. And China literally is, because they have this sort of mentor, student relationship. And your teacher, your magic teacher, probably only knows five tricks.
Well, and they seem to, and this is all secondhand from my perspective, but it's from what I've heard, it sounds like they regard magic as essentially juggling, where it's like a set. You do these moves and the best you could do is execute them flawlessly.
Yeah, magic in there is part of the, you know, the event was put on, sponsored by the Shanghai Circus. And wonderful job, wonderful people, and it's part of the circus, it's part of acrobatics. And so half of my audience were acrobats. And so, yeah, it's absolutely in that school. And I don't know if that's a bad thing, but that does mean that you're in a mindset where you just do what the person before you taught you and you don't get as much innovation. And that's concerning. But the thing that concerned me was that you know, copying was so rampant there that, you know, if you had a kid who was a young version of me, he's not even going to think about the idea of what if I spent my, you know, full day trying to invent, you know, work as a performer, then spent my full time inventing, because he wouldn't be able to. He wouldn't be able to support himself.
Right. Wow.
And that's sort of my concern where it comes from, you know, when I think about, you know, that situation. But I was in Shanghai. It was fantastic. Still talk to the young people there. These kids are bright. They're alert. They're very, very worldly. I'll tell you this. And, you know, number ones I talked to who'd been to the West, had been to America, you know, they speak, you know, multiple languages, and very curious, very, very ambitious in their own way. Not as entrepreneurial as we may think, but absolutely positive, exciting experience. You know, you go to a shopping mall there, which is the nicest shopping mall I've ever been in. It's seven stories, and I sit in a Cold Stone Creamery, and I'm the most poorly dressed kid there. And there's, you know, there are young people there in, you know, business suits and stuff, playing on their iPhones and their iPads, carrying on. I could have been in Manhattan. And, you know, that's to show you that, you know, how ubiquitous, you know, our modern culture is. And I hesitate to call it American culture, because it's really, you know, it's world culture coming to one sort of point, and people saying, you know what, these are the coolest things here. Let's, you know, do this around the world.
Wow.
So very positive experience. And again, where I was, Shanghai, it's not China. You know, that's, you know, one of the largest cities in the world, but China's 1.3 billion people. Shanghai is something like 20, 30 million people. Rest of China, I didn't see. So I have no idea, you know, what the rest of China is like.
Right.
Do they have like an America town?
What's that?
Do you have like a Chinatown?
You go in and they're like, here, it's a burger that you eat with chopsticks.
I hear it's kind of like Dollywood. You know? it's like their interpretation of everything.
They actually, in Shanghai, they actually have like a French Quarter and all that. Because, you know, Shanghai's had Westerners living there for a number of years. There's a place called the Bund, which is all these Western buildings. These Western-style buildings were built a long time ago across the, you know, the part of the Yangtze River. And you look across there and you see downtown Shanghai with the super high, you know, some of the tallest buildings in the world, and it looks like Blade Runner, but really, really clean. And it's just it's an amazing city.
I just like to see there like a part of it that was just a bunch of people being really stereotypically American. Like, you know, they're like, go to America town. It's like, hey, you get out of my way.
Right.
Only they're mixing up the cultures. They're like, hey, you
howdy,
get out of
partner.
My way. Howdy.
Well, no. It'd be actual Americans. They just want to get together and be super American together. And they'll
I will tell you this. And that is that, you know, in talking to some young people there, I met a number of young people who, when I say young, like early 20s, that would speak. And when they didn't want the grown-ups or people around them to hear them talking about things like Facebook or YouTube, they would talk in English.
Wow.
Oh, that's interesting.
So, and they go like, well, you know, if you really, like, you have a bunch of Shanghai hipster, like, natives that were like, well, if you really want the best corn dog, you have to go down to America town.
They deep fat fry it in lard.
Yeah, I tell you what, they love McDonald's and KFC there. KFC especially.
Why?
Because it's dope. Oh my God, it's the best thing ever. They love it too because they're smart.
Speaking of science, you know, Penny was like, oh, what's that smell? It smells kind of like French fries. McDonald's. You know, it's like do they pipe out that smell from...
From McDonald's?
From McDonald's. I mean, well,
okay, let me tell you what. You go to the modern part of Shanghai, the George Jetson looking thing, and I took the most awesome ride in a tunnel I've ever taken in my life. It was like a space mountain under the river to get to the other side. Okay. I think I showed Justin the video of this.
Yes.
Okay.
It's pretty awesome.
And you come out and you look up and you're like, you're in the future. And there's this walkway, this elevated walkway, this circular walkway in the center of the city. Okay. And all the modern buildings are there. You've got that iconic, the Pearl TV tower, which is these three orbs. And there's the huge buildings and all that there. And you walk on this walkway and it's like those elevated things you see in the future. And there's people walking around all around. And the two things that really stood out to me is one, there's very, very high tech, you know, concrete and chrome and glass building. And inside of there is McDonald's, where there's a line to the door. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then at the opposite end, pretty much in the city center, there is the glass cylinder for, it's the counterpart to the Fifth Avenue Apple Cube, is the Shanghai cylinder for Apple.
No way. Oh. Now, is it real Apple or is it
real? No,
knockoff?
This is Shanghai. This is real Apple.
Okay.
This is
all
real
right.
Apple. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and that's like everybody there, you know, I saw the Steve Jobs biography everywhere.
Wow.
I mean,
I got a copy. He bought me a Chinese copy of the Steve Jobs biography, which I've put out on my coffee table just to troll people.
Yeah. They're like, oh, you thought you'd get insights as the master of Apple? Sorry, you're too dumb for this knowledge.
You better study up on Mandarin, jerk.
That's right. I talked to a couple girls who were acrobats, and one of them had mentioned something like, you know, I think
that was the best way to start a sentence.
Yeah, I was thinking that too. I was like,
great
did
way
you
to
now?
Start a sentence.
what did I say?
Nothing.
I was talking to two girls who were acrobats.
Two Chinese girls who are acrobats. You know, on my journeys to China.
It almost sounds like the beginning of a rap lyric.
Yeah, you realize
I thought it sounded
finally,
more like Playboy.
We were at a Shanghainese restaurant off the beaten path. They're actually from Tianjin, which is a province outside of Beijing, and they'd come to the conference. And, you know, the usual.
Okay, you realize, Andrew, I need to see, next time I see you perform live on stage, I need to see a fundamental shift in your presentation. You can finally be that cliche magician who says, in my journeys to the Far East,
yes.
I discovered a magical box.
Wait, and now he has to have like a zigzag that has Chinese symbols on it.
Say his name. You all know you want to say his name. Just say it.
Well, anyhow. So I'm sitting there, and what we think was kind of interesting is that two of the I'd given one of these props that I make, my fold up sword basket. This girl had asked if she could buy it for me, and I didn't want to like be there and like, you know, be the, you know, like, no, I'll make you pay for this thing. And I gave it to her, and then she and her friend said, well, let us take you to dinner. I'm like, no, oh, right, I didn't like this. And so I went out to dinner with them, and only one of them spoke English, and it was very, very neat conversation. And Kathy, who is my Chinese sister now, she was my translator, she's awesome. She was there. And so it was a lot of fun. But anyhow, Apple came up, and Kathy is just excited because she sent me an iMessage that she just got her iPhone 4S. One of these girls says to me, she goes, oh, I love Steve Jobs. And I go, really? And I just bought the Steve Jobs bio and I hadn't read it. And I go, well, did you read the book? She says, oh, yes, I read the book. And I'm thinking, great. Chinese girl from middle of China has already read the book and I haven't. Okay. And I said to her, I said, well, why do you like Steve Jobs? And
she's like, not mean enough. He should be more mean now that he is Ghost Man.
Okay, she was using a Samsung phone, which I thought was interesting. I said, why do you like Steve Jobs? And she said, you know, his life had a lot of ups and downs, and I feel like I could relate. And I'm like, that's a really powerful sort of thing to hear. You know, that, you know, she's a person kind of looking at this guy from she wanted to get the iPhone 4S, of course. The other girl sitting next to her goes, I hate Apple. And I go, like, really? I go, why do you hate Apple? And she goes, I used to work for a video company and I had to use Final Cut all the time, and I didn't have the documentation, so I can't stand it. I can't stand it.
Well, like, I mean, look, Americans are no more rational. Like, for all, we could dress it up.
I didn't think that was rational at all. I'm thinking, like, if I had to sit there and I only understood a little bit of English and I didn't have the Chinese documentation, I had to use Final Cut, I would hate it.
Yeah. No, fair enough.
I thought both were very rational statements. I thought, it was just interesting, though. So that's that was my China experience. And there was the massage parlor, and that was awesome.
But you came back with a bad case of China syndrome.
Yeah, I'm going to go back. I'm trying to learn Chinese now.
Exactly.
Told
Finally,
you.
Finally, you can learn the secret of General So.
I actually had their version of that there.
I think.
But did they serve it to you where a guy was wearing a uniform and he just calls it my chicken?
Andrew, I think the next time you perform at a conference, you should do those five tricks.
Right.
In my journeys.
I learned the mystery of the linking rings.
I love Bonnie's just dogged insistence on the crappy magic.
Here's the problem, Bonnie.
Magic cliches are amazing.
I couldn't really get in there and be like, listen, you guys got to be a lot more original and creative, because I go to magic competitions, you know, when I have to go see them in the United States, and it's the same damn five tricks. So it's like...
The same ones that they did over there, or the same ones?
Yeah, oh yeah.
The only difference is that they're state-sanctioned over there.
Yeah.
Magic hacks are worldwide.
Yes.
It's a global phenomenon.
Can I make a guess?
Sure.
I'd like to
which
guess.
Tricks?
Yeah, which yeah. tricks? Let me.
Go.
My first is a zombie. Wait, is it called the zombie
ball?
The
zombie ball, yeah.
Yeah, the zombie ball. And then some teenager drops it and drops the F-bomb.
I mean, they're...
And then... or acrobat, teenage acrobat. No, they wouldn't drop it because they're more trained than that.
Yeah.
But then the other one is a linking ring. The linking rings is pretty obvious.
Yeah.
And then
a strong one. Good answer.
You got three. Good answer. Show me linking rings.
Exactly.
Ding.
Oh man. And then I usually am sleeping through the middle of the act. So let me think of what else.
Actually, what it was like card manipulation, the card productions.
Oh yeah. Except nobody's like, that talented here because they're not acrobats.
So. No, magic convention deals
doesn't stop them from trying.
You'll see 15-year-old boys who have not discovered girls yet. Are very good at that here.
You can channel some serious energy into hiding cards behind the back of your hand.
So they had that. They'd do that. The card that they would do fans, the parasols and stuff. But it was a lot of just the card stuff, the over the card productions and stuff. And I was like, all right.
Did they do water bowls?
No, they didn't do like traditional. I mean, it was just more of kind of the manipulation magic. But it was, you know, I think that, you know, it was encouraging to the fact
it's
that
like,
you know,
the miser's dream.
Yeah, I mean, it was the people there put on the conference, and part of the goal was they wanted to bring in people who were excited about creativity and would, you know, share that with people there.
So at the end of the competition, or the was it a competition or
there was a competition that was part of it.
At the end of the competition, did he stand up and look at you and say, see what we're talking about here?
No, I wasn't part of that. Any of that. Thankfully, I wasn't a judge or anything. I was just there to go give one talk.
How awkward would that be to go halfway around the world and then see magic that you don't approve of and be like, and? And you're like,
I was there. Max Maven was there. And a few other people, and we were Rory Johnston from Magic Magazine, and we were honest, we were very honest because, about where, Max in particular was very, very honest about where he thought, the China Magic was at the state that it was, and, the fact that he dressed like, a guy out of a Chinese historical movie, probably helped endear him to
Did
the
he
listeners.
Really?
Oh yeah, Max's style. You know, it's funny. Like, you didn't see a single. I didn't see anybody in Shanghai who was dressed in anything that you would have said was like that's Chinese clothing.
Everybody looked Western.
Yeah, it was Western. Very, very Western. And unconsciously, it was not like, oh, we're trying to look Western. It was just like, hey,
No, that's just what they wear. That's one of those things. I forget which lecture I saw it in originally, but it was a breakdown of. Different depictions of the future in popular culture. And the stereotypical vision of the future is something where all the architecture matches. It's all white. Everybody dresses alike. It's all very central planned. But then on the other side, you had Blade Runner, which was super dirty and gritty. You had this mishmash of different cultures and advertisements everywhere. It was hideous, but also beautiful in its hideousness. And sure enough, the Blade Runner is 100% right. That's where we're headed, is to this bizarre mishmash of cultures.
But clean. Here's the thing, though. And this was an epiphany I had when I was living in Japan.
God, wow!
I was talking with 14 acrobats at the same time.
And I said to my sensei, I know you don't think I have any more to learn here at the temple, but I think that.
Oh my God!
When I was
another in Tokyo, vodka gimlet.
I was walking through Tokyo, and I looked up and I looked around me, and I was in one of those big shopping districts, and I said, I feel like I'm in Manhattan. I feel like I could be in Manhattan right now. And that was the realization. And then I was in Venezuela visiting my girlfriend at the time, whose father was a colonel in the military, but let's not get into that. And I was in, downtown Caracas, and I had the same sort of thought. I said, I feel like I could be – all these big cities start to feel alike in the sense that there are all these different confluences of culture and styles like that. And – in Shanghai, it's the same thing. Shanghai, very, very modern and stuff. And these kids, they're choosing things. A lot of the kids there wanted to learn French because they loved French culture. They seemed like very much like American, but they looked at the world and looked at things all around there and said, what do I like here and there?
Right. Well, it's funny you should mention that because if I can pull a mini Andrew here. When I lived in Norway,
You lived in Norway?
Oh yeah, no, for a year and a half I lived in Stavanger, Norway. Yeah. When I was in the 7th and 8th grade, and it was a great time too, cuz that's around the age where the American consumerism really gets its hooks into you and you start
American consumerism.
You know what? I actually read up about that in a parenting magazine.
Really?
American consumerism?
Yes,
Well, let me tell you my experience real quick, and then we'll get Bonnie to elaborate on what that means biologically. But my experience was at seventh grade, my whole life was about TV, hanging out at the mall, and buying stuff, and then all of a sudden I was pulled out of that into this world of there's exactly two channels. One of them was in English. And, and there was no shopping malls or fried chicken or any of the things that I had come to depend on. But during that time, I wanted very much to have an American-like experience. And in all of my time at Norway, the thing that felt the most American to me was when we went to the Chinese food restaurant in Norway. There was something about it that reminded me of being in America going to Chinese food restaurants.
Yeah.
But what were you saying about consumerism?
Oh, well, at that age, that stage of development, friendships are very Children don't really understand the concept of friendship, that they can be deep and long lasting. All they think that you need is the right clothes or the right hair or the right whatever. So, you know, later on we get more sophisticated. But at that time, you know, kids just want the Gucci or they want the this or they want the right high tops.
What they want is the trappings of belonging with everyone else.
Right. And at that age, that's all they need. It really does work. And that's the problem. And so it sounds like when you went to Norway right at that stage, then you got to sidestep all that because
it was fundamentally one of the most important things that ever happened to me, to all of a sudden be pulled out of you know, because I thought I had pretty good social standing at the time and I was dressing like the other kids and all that stuff, mm-hmm. and then to get pulled out of all of that and then to go to a private American school where my entire class was only 19 people, I mean, it was amazing.
Well, you know, Brian, that reminds me of when I was 20 years old and in Sofia, Bulgaria. I took a whiz on the street and lost $75 at a crooked casino.
That sounds so Justin.
I totally believe that.
I really buy it. I just really do.
That is actually true.
Oh, my God.
I just wanted to say things. Yes.
See, we're all up in this international business.
I just object to the term of American consumerism. That's all.
Now, why is that? You don't think that it's a uniquely American thing?
Nah, I think that, you know, when we go to these big, you know, we go to these cities and we see this sort of the different cultures there. I wonder, like, okay, if we went to a major Roman port town, 2,000 years ago, what would it have been like if we went to places where you have a bunch of different cultures there in a bazaar and marketplaces and stuff like that? You know, when you give chimpanzees tokens and the ability to press levers and stuff, they don't behave any differently than any other nationality.
Okay, then in retroactively, pretend I said American-style consumerism, because when you are in 7th and 8th grade, it's a pretty big shift to go from the world where breakfasts are bacon, egg, and cheese, to a new world where breakfast is fish. And, there a lot of it is very uncomfortable. And at that age, you don't seek out a lot of new experiences. Most people in 7th and 8th grade, that's around the time period that what they want to do is feel comfortable in their world and masters of their own domain. And, you know, and I did not at first, and that's why I sought out American-like experiences.
Yeah. I guess what I would say is sort of kind of qualify is that the thing that happens is when we talk about these other countries, oh, they're becoming more Americanized. But you have countries that don't have as much access to, let's say, as American television as other countries do. Like, you know, there are places in Asia and Africa where all they do is watch American television.
Wow.
But they don't have middle class economies. And so you don't see these aspects of consumption. But once they have the economy starts to get to that parity, then you see these things. And so I sort of think it's a manifestation of having, I guess, disposable incomes and access to markets that really causes that. And not so much this idea that when we barrage them with our culture, because there is that idea that we're these cultural imperialists.
Right.
I think people are intelligent. I think people are smart. And I think we're pragmatic. And so I always kind of like, yeah. And I know you weren't making that sort of claim. I think it was just kind of like, I'm like, I don't think we, invented that.
You like rocking your face off? Well, you should listen to Sweet Water. Oh, that's sweet, sweet water. They're a rocking band out of a little town called Seattle. Well, what have they ever done for music? I don't know. The 90s? How about that? They're pretty awesome. You're listening to them right now. I'm playing them under this. If you like NSFW show, you better get ready for some Sweetwater, because we're going to have them on. They're pretty awesome. Sweetwater. Find them at SweetwaterRocks.com or SweetwaterRocks on Twitter.
Well, you know, speaking of American-style consumerism, would you guys like to make some picks?
You know what? Actually, I do, and I have two already picked out here for you guys. You ready? I'm going to lay this business on you. First off, talking about, the way the Chinese view magic as doing those same five tricks or whatever, that's a theme that reminded me of Penn and Teller's Magic and Mystery Tour from 2003, where they went to Egypt and China and I forget the other place.
India,
yeah, to see how other cultures do magic. It is on Netflix, but it looks like only the Egypt episode is up on Netflix. But you could do that instant streaming and see how other cultures preserve or, you know, tackle the idea of magic. And then from a science fiction.
And well, real quick about that, uniquely suited to do something like that. It's like right in their wheelhouse, the Penn and Teller.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like, well, and I remember one of the things they talked about was the bizarreness of how the state-run theme park had a magic stage that people would come out every 15 minutes, and now they didn't have any climate control in there. So it's like it's literally below 0 degrees. They're sitting in the audience. They are the only two people in the entire audience wearing heavy parkas, and out come these kids doing their acrobatic stuff on the 15-minute mark, doing the linking rings and those same five tricks that Andrew was talking about, like human automata. You know, it's a fascinating look into that kind of stuff, and it's very Penn and Teller, which you know, either means something good or bad depending on where you come from as far as Penn and Teller. But on the science fiction side, I'm currently reading the American translation of 1Q84, which takes place in Japan, and it's obviously, you know, there's a few moments where it's strange, the language barrier, and they have to explain that they, you know, they're reading characters or kanji, you know, this particular way and so on. But I'm almost done with it. I'm enjoying it a lot, but I'm concerned at the fact that I'm now on the last portion of the story, and I can't honestly say what the point of it was. Like, I know what happened, and I saw it's very dreamy and it's very surreal, and I'm going to be very glad that I've read it, but until I quite get to the end, it's not a nail biter and it's not an adventure story. But if you're looking for some of that kind of odd take on parallel worlds and a more dreamy kind of science fiction, I think you'll enjoy it. If you enjoyed Einstein's Dreams, that kind of thing,
well, you may get a kick out of it. The Murakami character who writes that, he's a fairly famous futurist, right? Like Japanese futurist.
I don't know. Let me check that out.
I believe. I mean, I've heard. When you were talking about it, I thought, is that the Murakami book? And although I've never read
yep,
any of
it is.
Work,
Haruki yeah. Murakami. Yeah. So that is correct.
That fella there. So
well,
that's cool.
Played.
I'd be curious to read it. I know a lot of people who know, a lot of people whose taste I respect speak highly of Murakami's work.
Yeah, and I think it'll be one of those stories that's
I think
sticky.
It's Murakami. I mean, just Murakami is a different name in person.
Okay. Yeah, Murakami. But I suspect this will be one of the stories that sticks with me for a long time, even though as I'm reading it, I'm not entirely sure who the villain is or who the good guy is or really even what the plot is.
The hell is happening?
Yes. Well, no, I'm aware of what's happening, but it's like, it's funny because it's like I realized I'm coming on the end of the book and I'm like, wait a minute, what the hell's happened this entire story? And I can pretty much
say, are they ever going to stop looking for the girl?
Yeah, and when he's like not, I mean, he's not a sci-fi. He's like, you know, Gabriel Garcia Marquez. He's like a magical realist. So, you know, it's going to be more, you know, I guess Kafka kind of stuff than straight up kind of.
Yes. No, that would say that's correct. This is far from hard science fiction. It's very, like I say, dreamy. What about you, Bonnie? You got anything to pick?
Just what I've been watching lately is Into the Universe, the Stephen Hawking.
Oh, with Stephen Hawking. That's up on Netflix Instant Streaming now.
Now, on the downside, my 7-year-old seems to be able to grasp all of what they're saying. So it is written to a kind of a sub level, but it is engaging and visually stimulating, and it's pretty cool. So every now and then you're like, oh, I learned something.
Probably because Penny likes robot voices.
Oh, well, yeah, and they do a good job of transitioning back and forth from the robot voice to what they kind of establish as the voice in his head of how he would talk or how he used to talk or how he talks in his mind. It's very weird to see the packaging of somebody so non-Hollywood like Stephen Hawking.
Oh, he's like you feel like you get to know him a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
You know? You really feel like you get to know this character through, I mean, maybe it's just Hollywood that's, or, you know.
No, that's his writing. I mean, if you read you know, any of his stuff, you know, Brief History of the Universe or Briefer History of the Universe, Universe in a Nutshell, I mean, he's got some humor to him. And there's a lot going inside, and I think that's part of what makes him such an engaging personality.
Right. Well, so that's pretty interesting. And then what you had, like, a science...
Oh, I did too, because I cheated.
Oh, you cheated. So we're
one thing before we get off of Stephen Hawking. There is a, I believe, on his first HBO special, and it's unbearably vulgar, but David Cross has an impression of Stephen Hawking.
Oh, my God.
It's all I ever want to say whenever anybody talks about Stephen Hawking.
That is so Justin.
No, one of the most brilliant
physicists. Vulgar.
One of the most brilliant physicists of our lifetimes. Justin's like, I know a dirty joke about that guy.
Oh, my God, but it's so funny.
Well, I remember, you know, Michael Shermer of Skeptic, you know, talked about kind of a neat story was when Stephen Hawking, one of the first times he went to go speak at UCLA, and they set up speakers out in the quad out there so people could listen, you know, because it was just, you know, not only could they fill the entire auditorium, as they had, you know, thousands of people there sitting in the grass to listen to him talk.
Wow. Well, I forgot what like pop culture cartoon recently, but Penny was watching it and said, on Hawking's chair.
Oh, yeah, by Hawking's chair.
By Hawking's chair. I just thought that was amazing. So funny.
Andrew?
All right. So my little pick is a film that I saw the last time I think I saw it all the way through was in the movie theaters a long time ago. And I walked out of the going, you know, I dug this. And I thought at the time I was a little bit ambivalent about it. And then I went and I watched it again. And I dug it even more, and I wasn't at all ambivalent about it. I went to go read some of the reviews, and I realized they were like, well, we weren't sure. And I'm like, no, I absolutely just unequivocally liked it. It's written by David Mamet, directed by Lee Tamahari, and it's The Edge, starring Anthony Hopkins and Alec Baldwin.
Wow. This doesn't even register on my radar. I had no idea that there was a David Mamet project that I wasn't even aware of.
So here's the premise, Brian. Anthony Hopkins plays this
Anthony
eccentric
Hopkins.
Billionaire. eccentric billionaire. You know, the brilliant, this guy knows all these facts, dating a woman who looks and acts exactly like Ellie McPherson because she's playing, it's Ellie McPherson.
Right.
He goes off to this remote part of Alaska with her and her photographer and this group of people because she's going to do a fashion shoot. And he reluctantly agrees to go along. And he and Alec Baldwin and a couple other people end up getting lost in the woods of Alaska and have to survive. And there is a killer Kodiak bear out there.
Wow.
The bear, by the way, played by Bart the Bear, one of the best animal actors ever.
Wait a minute.
Genuine Kodiak bear who was, you know, okay. Humongous. If you ever get a chance, look up Bart the Bear on YouTube. Okay?
Was he
actually
Anchorman?
A lot of speculation on whether or not he died on a boat with Robert Wagner and Christopher Walken recently.
Bart, I'm actually a Natalie Wood fan. So that's not...
Dude, you know what? I just looked it up. Bart the Bear has an IMDb. Bart the Bear.
Oh my God.
Is known. He was in The Bear. He was in The Edge. Yep. He was in Legends of the Fall. The Great Outdoors. Meet the Deedles. On Deadly Ground.
Went up on Meet the Deedles.
let's see. White Fang. The Great Outdoors. Louis L'Amour. Down the Long Hills.
All right. You know what we need to do right now? We need a YouTube moment where let me find a clip for you to go watch, like Bart with his trainer.
Yeah.
Because you got to understand, Bart's not just, he's not just a bear. Bart's like one of the largest bears you will get. He's a you know, a Kodiak, which is like grizzly family. Okay, so he is ginormous.
I'm looking at these photos.
2 years at fullback in the NFL. Guess which team? Seahawks.
I'm looking at these photos, and it is super impressive. It is amazing.
Let me pull this up for you.
Actually, just go to YouTube and type in Bart the Bear. and click on the third link down, which is Doug Seuss and Bart the Bear.
All right. I'm
okay. And what it is, he's out there running Bart the Bear through all emotions.
Enjoy this newly rediscovered video of animal trainer Doug Seuss and the original Bart the Bear during an exhibition.
The original Bart. There were many Bart the Bears?
After Bart passed away, they named another bear after him.
Did they really?
Yeah.
Wow.
We will call you New Bart.
They got, like, look at the way he's roughhousing with this bear. And I guess, I mean, it's one of those things when you're a bear, you don't really feel much of a punch from a guy. Like, he's full on punching him in the face, like in a kidding kind of like, oh, you rascal, pow, to the kisser. I mean, this is amazing.
And just for our listeners, give people the idea of how big. This is not a circus bear that would hop onto.
No. Okay, this thing is. I mean, if it stood on its hind legs, would be twice as tall as a person.
He's 9 foot tall.
He looks easily 600 pounds. I mean,
right.
This thing.
No.
He's, how far up am I?
You're probably at he weighed 1,500 pounds.
Okay. Wow. He's easily a billion pounds.
Yes. There's, I mean, go to Wikipedia
so
and type in Bart the Bear and look at the photo there of Bart at his fullest next to his trainer.
I'm a fan of this bear.
Are you looking at the photo?
Oh, no. I'm watching the video right now. He's catching fruit thrown at him. He's
go to
doing dances.
Pop open, look at the photo on Wikipedia, Bart the Bear.
And let's just say this. His trainer, Doug Seuss, is like a gigantic human. Like, he is like, if he walked into a bar, you'd look and be like, oh my God, that guy is gigantic. And next to this bear, he looks like just a wee lad.
Yeah, Doug Seuss looks like a pro wrestler, but next to Bart the Bear, you know, he looks like if a Bears decided that they wanted to have their version of teddy bears.
It'd be his trainer.
Yeah, there's a great photo, though. If you go to Wikipedia and go look at Bart the Bear, the photo, the best, it's his photo of Bart the Bear standing upright in his full bareness.
By the way, also, according to Wikipedia, the following actors were very impressed by how well-trained Bart the Bear was. John Candy, Dan Aykroyd, Annette Bening, Ethan Hawke, Steven Seagal, Gregory Peck, some Japanese guy, Brad Pitt, Alec Baldwin, Anthony Hopkins. The last one, Hopkins, twice, because he loved working with Bart so much.
Wow. Bart was also the spokesbear for the Animal Cancer Center at Colorado State University.
The Japanese guy was a French actor in the bear.
it did look like a Japanese name.
I know we did the bear, which with French people. I looked.
No, apparently
it up,
he's
like
a Turkish
born yeah.
French actor musician named Jackie Keru.
Yeah.
Jackie Keru.
All right, what do you got, Justin?
So The Edge. That's my pick. Yeah.
I like the part in the movie where the bear starts playing Where the Streets Have No Name. my pick is a serious film about love and loss.
Hotel
and
for
one
Dogs.
Chance to bring it
oh,
all
the
together.
Porn Buffy the Vampire Slayer that's out?
Muppets.
Oh.
Gosh darn it. Those furry friends are out there causing mischief in theaters everywhere, and I loved it. I took my little brother, he's 6 years old, and I asked him on the way to the theater because he wanted to go see it. I'm like, hey, you want to go see the Muppets? He's like, yeah. So I asked him, so how do you know the Muppets? And he's like, oh, they're on commercials on Disney Channel. And so I'm like, all right, well, we'll see how he likes it. And he loved it. Oh my God, clapping after every song is the most adorable thing I've ever seen. I wrote a whole thing on Weird Things, if you want to head on over there, about why they're still relevant and how much I like the movie and how much the movie sort of went toward kind of reestablishing the brand and you know, it's probably something where it'd be worth it to rewatch some of those later Muppet movies and just kind of compare where the franchise was there compared to the kind of start it's gotten off to now. But just absolutely fantastic. It really calls out all the stops. And my favorite part of the movie is just looking at how much love that franchise has by the number of non-speaking cameo parts are just filled with, you know, name celebrities, yeah, like people you've seen.
Bonnie, did you know, you remember the alternate version of the Muppets, the Moopets? You remember it was a bunch of Muppets, and then there was one human playing drums? The human was animal, basically. Did you notice that was Dave Grohl of Foo Fighters?
Oh,
I totally didn't even notice
God,
that.
That's hilarious. Well, I recognized him, but I was like, ah,
don't spoil
so
it for me. I haven't seen it yet.
There's well, so listen, many. Listen. There's and that'll be the only cameo you spoil, because there's a lot of really, really, really funny ones. But that's just one of those things where I looked up on screen and like you see him and he's just kind of standing there awkwardly. He has no lines. But it's this knockoff, you know, Muppets thing. And I look over at my 6-year-old little brother and I'm like, hey, that's Dave. You have no idea who he is. but yeah, no, I highly, highly, highly recommend it. And the songs are fantastic. Soundtrack's well worth listening to. Co-written, the majority of the best songs of the movie are co-written by
Brett McKenzie
from Flight of the Conchords,
which, and by the way, that's sort of a denouement to our Night Attack comedy album, where we're asking what happened to Flight of the Conchords. The answer is they're doing the Muppets.
Well, one of them is, and you know, it's yeah, the one who hasn't done movies now does the soundtrack to this, and it really is. I mean, like, two of the songs very much kind of seem like Flight of the Conchords songs without cursing or adult themes. But the big power ballad and the main theme that gets reprised at the end are just great musical numbers that are just very much in tone with the Muppet, you know, like cute but not dumb and funny but not, you know, sarcastic or dirty kind of tone. So
that was my impression. Like, I very rarely go to a movie and just say, I want the soundtrack. But, like, I was just so impressed with the quality of the music in the Muppets. And I was glad that they put the effort to power it home.
Because it's not, I mean, you can get away with crappier songs.
Yeah,
you know,
that's what I was thinking. It would still be a really great movie, even if the songs had
row, row, row your boat. Fozzie and Gonzo.
As a guy who's been a longtime fan of the Muppets, by the way, Justin, if you need to borrow those movies or the TV show, I've got them on my shelf. I there was that dark period where they kind of decided to do that. All they needed to do is put a bunch of felt Muppets on screen and write anything for them, and that's how we got, you know, Muppets in Outer Space. That's how
Muppets
we got
Christmas
Kermit
Carol.
The Swamp Ears.
I like Muppets Christmas Carol.
Actually, Michael Caine is amazing in that.
I thought it was pretty good.
But it wasn't, I don't know. It was just a straight up storytelling of, you know, familiar turf.
Okay, but like a straight up retelling of a Christmas Carol, Michael Caine and the Muppets. You can't go wrong.
Right? I mean, you can't deviate too much.
Bite your tongue, sir.
All right.
I didn't bring that. No, I mentioned Muppets in Outer Space. Okay. Okay, that's when, if you look at the Muppets, when they think they really started to go off the rail, was Muppets Christmas Carol was kind of fun and it had its own charm to it. But after, when you got the Muppets in Outer Space and you like Kermit the Swamp Years and these other things that were just, you know, and people will go, Andrew, they weren't meant for you. Lies, lies, lies.
Well, I mean, and that's the beautiful thing, is that this movie is meant for, it is a scatter bomb of joy, and it hits all demographics, you know, and I think at times, if I had any minor quibble with the film, is I think that they were kind of aiming, you know, that this movie ultimately will mean more to my little brother than it will mean to me, you know, because I think if he really enjoys it, then he has far more many years to, you know, enjoy it. If they make more Muppet movies, then, you know, obviously at that age, things just are bigger and mean more. So I think, yeah, when they get kind of Jay and Silent Bob-ish with their, like, don't you remember when we did this? But it's so minor.
Well, and it's also, not only is it minor, but it's not even fair, because you're arguing on behalf of the perspective of a 5-year-old and how you imagine he's seeing it. Because
I'm just saying, spoke to you. Yeah. Oh, I mean, yeah, he could not have, yeah, he probably didn't care. So, I mean, it's minor.
Can I just say this? And I'm still not on the guy that does the Kermit voice now. He's been doing it for years. It's looking on the IMDb. It's Steve Whitmire. It's not quite Kermit for me.
Oh, no. It's
Kermit's never coming back.
I've been massaged, and now I hear Kermit now.
Okay.
It was a little bit off for me early on after Jim Henson's passing, but now I just hear Kermit. It's kind of like when they changed the voice of Carl on Aqua Teen Hunger Force. It was jarring at first, but eventually you appreciated the new Carl.
All right.
But Andrew, I have seen that a couple times in the reviews of people that, you know, in one of the big musical numbers, which is a reprise of something that Kermit has sung before, that it felt like a cover as opposed to, you know, the original song. So, I mean, I guess it's one of those things where, like, either we get this Kermit or we get no Kermit at all, right?
Yeah, or exactly. Worst case scenario, we get some kind of Forrest Gump-esque, like, we digitally took the old Kermit and put his voice in the new.
I mean, there are people who could do, like, you know, who could do Mickey Mouse, you never knew it was the difference. There are people who can do, like, Homer Simpson and stuff, and you don't know the difference. I mean, there are actors who, there's a guy, a comedian, a white guy who does Eddie Murphy's voice for the Shrek movies when there's stuff that they don't get Murphy to go dub in as Donkey. And you never know it's him.
Wow.
You know, and so that's kind of, I guess that's kind of a thing. It's like, well, you know, because this is a guy who was, you know, part of the Henson crew and all that. And when Jim wasn't able to do or continue doing it, you know, he, you know, was the guy who could do the closest voice. But there are a lot of voices out there that can do Kermit spot on. And this always just sounded a little bit off to me. Made me sad.
You know, the puppetry was so good, though. I mean, it had to be. But, like I felt several times like, oh, that is Kermit, you know, because he's like, I mean,
oh my
just
God.
That little felt face could express
emotion. I'll pretend it's like new Bono in U2, you know, after the voice is not quite the same.
And this is the last thing I'll say, is that I've almost found the press tour surrounding the Muppets to be as impressive as a feat as them doing that movie. You know, they have taken the Muppets in so many different venues and had to play, you know, these away games and just, you know, the most varied, you know, morning shows. They did print interviews with every outlet who wanted one. They did a live spot on Saturday Night Live with Jason Segel. They were on the WWE Raw War 3 weeks ago. And it's just like,
We could book them on NSFW.
I'll tell you what. I think we'd pass an opportunity. We could have had the Muppets on NSFW because I don't know if they turned down a press request. And it was just amazing. And we put something on Weird Things with my Muppets thing when I was in illustrating the songs. But with Brett from Flight of the Conchords, they have a thing that the New York Times recorded. And it's just him and Kermit, you know, sitting Kermit style on the edge of his piano, and they're like singing the main song from the movie and just kind of like riffing, but it's not just like a music video, like they started and then they start singing. It's like session players, like they're just like restarting and joking around with each other. It's so amazing, you know. The Muppets did, I mean, that press tour did so much to kind of just cement the idea that the Muppets are real. Real things that are running around society, and it's amazing and beautiful, and I'm glad they're back in our lives.
Can I say like a little bit of a kind of a Schadenfreude kind of moment, which is probably inappropriate, but
yes,
I love the fact that we've embraced the Muppets. The Muppets have made come back, and we feel they're real, and we like them in this age of CG and 3D and all this stuff that we get a bunch of guys in felt in their hands that we feel engaged and we like. And we're starting to have this sort of thing because there was this trend for like very scary, dead eye looking CG where, you know, you look at some of these movies that have come out where it was just, you know, not like Pixar stuff where it's really just done.
We're talking about like Beowulf and the Polar Express.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah. And those movies cost, those things, movies had budgets. Of
And the crappy Christmas Carol. Not the beautiful one with the Muppets and Michael Caine.
Yeah, Beowulf was a $150 million movie.
Wow.
And, you know, Muppets was made for
$50. Wow. Now, along that note, Penny was actually scared of the Muppets because...
At one point.
At
not
one
now.
Point. Not now. Now that she saw him on Disney Channel, she's all about it. But early on, she just wouldn't watch it because I think her brain had a hard time. They're like, wait, these are kind of real, and yet they're not real. You know,
it wasn't
and,
like a cartoon where there's one set of rules, or humanity where there's another set of rules. It was this perversion that
it sounds
was,
like good survival instincts.
Yeah,
you know, she sees some green belt exactly. guy walking along the street with bug eyes. Hey there, little girl, run,
exactly,
run away.
But I thought that was really interesting. I'm like, Penny, are you sure you want to go to this movie? Because I was sure that as soon as you know the title sequence passed, then she'd be like, running away screaming. But she,
she
loved it. She loved it so much.
Just one final note, and you mentioned you know Disney Channel. Obviously, the Muppets are now owned by Disney, and I really do feel that, like, especially having seen the movie, I'm very, very glad that, you know, whatever the brain, you know, the brain trust that is there in control of Disney now has control of this property. I think that this is a big vindication to people who are worried, you know, I think misguidedly, that, you know, Disney would not be a good home for such a great franchise. And, you know, there was a moment in, you know, part of the plot without spoiling anything involves financial insecurity for the Muppets.
Yeah.
And I was almost half expecting that at some point, you know, Disney would just, you know, ride in a white limousine and
full on self-referential. I love
it. Oh God, it would be, and you want to know what? I'd be happy. I'd be glad if that was the ending because I do think that it's a great home for them.
Yeah.
With the right people. Yeah. Exciting. Well, boys and girls, there are so many other things we didn't get to talk about.
Mm.
We'll just have to do this again real, real, real soon. I even tweeted out that I was excited about a couple stories we didn't even get to, which just tells you how much weird there is to share. Miss Bonnie Brushwood, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me on your show. This podcast. Is awesome. And
really
I didn't even get like
weirdthings.com. We didn't have you on the show.
Yeah, no, it's in my contract, in my marriage contract. Mm-hmm. I get to drop in on one podcast.
I think that's, is that under the for better or worse?
That's right, for worse. You have to be on a podcast.
And then bring the cookies, Mrs. Claus.
I'll bring them.
Oh, consider them brought.
Yeah, especially around Girl Scout time.
Yes.
So, Brian, whatever, Justin, yeah. It's been weird.
It's been slightly odd, this girl.
That reminds me of when I was a 19-year-old in Krakow, Poland.
Took me a second to remember that.